We'd like you to join us and perhaps with the greatest song ever written about our home, the father of American folk music, Pete Seeger, his grandson, Pal. Lead us, Pete.
You sing it with us. We'll give you the words. When I was walking that ribbon of highway,
as I went walking that ribbon of highway, I saw above me in the skyway. I saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me. This land is yours. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream water. This land was made for you and me.
A song that really needs no introduction. Sung joyously by Bruce Springsteen, Pete Seeger and thousands of others in 2009 as part of the celebrations for the inauguration of President Barack Obama. It's the song of that unconventional folk hero and vagabond troubadour Woody Guthrie, a prolific writer who famously emblazoned his guitar with the slogan, "This machine kills fascists." He spent his relatively short life telling myriad American stories in song. Amanda Smith with you, and on the music show this hour we're celebrating Woody Guthrie for the centenary of his birth on July the 14th, 1912. Robert Santelli is the author of a book called This Land Is Your Land, Woody Guthrie and the Journey of an American Folk Song. It looks at the life of Woody Guthrie through the prism of his most famous song, this song that became an American anthem and that now transcends generations and nations. Andrew Ford and Robert Santelli recently discussed all this via Skype, beginning though with Woody and another one of his famous songs.
Lots of folks back east, they say, is leaving home every day, beating a hot old dusty way to the California line. Across the desert sands they roll, getting out of that old dust bowl. They think they're going to a sugar bowl, but here's what they find. Now the police at the port of entry say, "You're number 14,000 for today. Oh, if you ain't got the do-re-mi, folks, you ain't got the do-re-mi. Why, you better go back to beautiful Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, Georgia, Tennessee. California is a garden of Eden, a paradise to live in or see. But believe it or not, you won't find it so hot if you ain't got the do-re-mi." You want to buy you a home or farm that can't deal nobody harm, or take your vacation by the mountains or sea. Don't swap your old cow for a car, you better stay right where you are. You better take this little tip from me, 'cause I look through the want ads every day, but the headlines on the papers always say, "If you ain't got the dough, pray me, boys, you ain't got the do-re-mi. Why, you better go back to beautiful Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, Georgia, Tennessee. California is a garden of Eden, a paradise to live in or see. But believe it or not, you won't find it so hot if you ain't got the do-re-mi."
That's one of Woody Guthrie's most famous songs, Do Re Mi, and we hear it by way of introducing Robert Santelli, who is talking to us via Skype from Kansas City, Missouri. Robert is the author of This Land Is Your Land, Woody Guthrie and the Journey of an American Folk Song. Welcome to the music show, Bob.
I'm happy to be here.
Let's talk. Well, maybe we should start with that song since we've heard it. And in a way, it introduces Woody Guthrie rather well. It certainly introduces the Woody Guthrie of the Dust Bowl, of the big Steinbeck connection. It could have been a song written for the movie almost, couldn't it, of Grapes of
That's
Wrath?
Right. Yes, you know, I mean, Woody Guthrie actually was, we believe, an unpaid consultant, music consultant to the movie The Grapes of Wrath. We believe he met John Steinbeck in Los Angeles, and Woody Guthrie was very moved, of course, by the book and even more moved by the movie. But there was always a connection there, and of course, the biggest connection being Woody Guthrie's great classic song, Tom Joad, yes, which of course is the story of The Grapes of Wrath in a nutshell, in a musical nutshell, if you will.
Perhaps you could take us back. We could talk about Woody Guthrie's first 27 years leading up to Steinbeck's novel in 1939. What was it that shaped Woody Guthrie, would you say?
Woody Guthrie, like many American songwriters in the early 20th century, was definitely a product of his environment. He was born in rural Oklahoma in 1912, and after a series of mishaps, personal and family mishaps, losing basically his mother to Huntington's disease, which would ultimately kill Woody, of course, in 1967, and also the onset of the Great Depression, moves him out of Oklahoma into nearby Texas, what we call the Texas Panhandle. And it was there that he felt and saw firsthand not only the ravages of the Great Depression, but also America's greatest economic and climate disaster, which was the Great Dust Bowl. He was there for Black Sunday, one of the worst dust storms ever in American history, from North Dakota and the tip of Canada all the way down to Mexico, a giant black dust cloud just covered the Great Plains. And Guthrie wrote about this and saw it with his own eyes, felt it, the dust up his nose. And after that, decides to go to California and follow the other Okies, as they were called, people from Oklahoma, and the Arkies, people from Arkansas, and the Texies, people from Texas. All these people hit the road looking for the promised land, looking for a better life. Their farms had been lost either to nature or to the banks due to foreclosure in the Great Depression. Their dreams had been shattered, their families had been broken, and they hit the highway. And along with them went Woody Guthrie to California in search of a better opportunity. And he gets there in the late 1930s and finds out that California dream for a lot of his people, if you will, turn into a California nightmare. There are no jobs. There's brutality from the police, thugs from the unions who beat them up, people who, 500-600 people trying to get two or three jobs picking peaches. It was a horrible, horrible time. And of course, Guthrie is the one who acknowledges this in his song, chronicles it, and it celebrates the resilience of the people. And John Steinbeck, of course, in The Grapes of Wrath, does exactly the same thing. So these two great American writers working on parallel paths here, the common denominator is really America in distress.
Yes, but the difference being that Woody Guthrie had absolutely lived this experience. The novel could have been, you know, about him virtually, couldn't it?
Yes, I mean, Guthrie was an Okie. Guthrie was someone with his thumb out and hitchhiking to get to California. And once he gets to California, he was really not anyone of consequence back in Pampa, Texas, or Okemah, Oklahoma, where he was born. Once he gets to California, he's been writing these songs. He's been listening to a lot of other people's songs, and he has the opportunity to get on the radio. And once he gets on the radio, just for 15 or 20 minutes at first, he starts to talk and play songs about the people who are displaced from Oklahoma and Texas and Arkansas, and they immediately connect to him because he speaks their language, he has that same southwestern drawl, and he's writing about things that concern him, you know, hungry kids, the inability to cross the state line from Arizona to California without a certain amount of money. And he writes a great song called Do Re Mi, which sarcastically and very effectively captures the essence and a frustration of what it was like to be a family coming across America and getting stopped at the border simply because you did not have enough money to enter California, which was a crime, a true sin, but nonetheless happened to hundreds and hundreds and even thousands of families. They were turned back and sent home to Oklahoma.
You're listening to The Music Show on RN, and my guest is Robert Santelli, who's the author, among other things, of This Land Is Your Land, Woody Guthrie, and The Journey of an American Folk Song. Let's talk about Woody the songwriter. At his height, he was unstoppable. He was writing several songs a day. They were pouring out of him. But where did it all start?
I think Guthrie, as a songwriter, couldn't help himself. He had to write. And if he wasn't writing songs, he was writing letters, or he was writing notes to himself, or poems, or pieces of journal writing. He just couldn't help himself. He had to express himself. I've never come across a more prolific person. We know he's written over 3,000 songs. We know that, for instance, he'd read a newspaper in the morning and be, say, moved by two or three articles that he read. He'd cut them out of the newspaper in the afternoon. He'd write songs about them. He was a musical editorial. You know, he was just a walking newspaper. He was someone who felt that he had to write, that he had a responsibility to his people. He had a responsibility to the underbelly of America to represent their feelings, account for their frustrations, and demand action with his songs. And he spent his entire life doing that until he could do it no more because of Huntington's disease, which would ultimately rob him of his mind, of his muscular structure, and ultimately of his life.
Yeah. The songs, what I'm saying they're songs, of course, in a way, they're lyrics, really, aren't they? I mean, he didn't really write that many tunes. He appropriated tunes. Do we know how he did it? Do we know whether he had a tune in mind and then fitted his words to it? Or was he so obsessed with writing down the words that he would write a lyric and then search around for a tune later that fitted the lyrics?
He did both. Guthrie, most of the time, however, would write the lyrics. He wrote them on all kinds of notebooks, on paper, on envelopes, wherever he could. My sense is that most of the songs came lyrics first and then the melody second. He did write melodies, but he didn't write a lot of melodies. He borrowed melodies from songwriters that he felt that he admired, for instance. This was, I should point out, something relatively common back before World War II. Many, many artists, bluesmen, folk artists, etc., they would make, in order to get their songs recognized and get their lyrics across, which they felt were most important, they would often borrow pieces of traditional melodies or popular melodies. And it was a common custom. So it wasn't that Guthrie was the only one doing it. Robert Johnson, the great bluesman, would do it often as well. But many, many people did this. And it was accepted. Of course, today, no longer accepted. But
as recently as the young Bob Dylan, of course. I mean, you know, Masters of War and Hard Rain's Gonna Fall are both based on traditional songs, aren't they? So I guess it's the last vestiges of the oral tradition.
That's right. That's right. And Bob Dylan's first song, A Song to Woody, one of the very first original songs he ever wrote, was a song that he wrote the lyrics to, and he borrowed the melody 1913 Massacre from Woody Guthrie.
Yes, yes. Which I suppose is also a form of tribute as well, isn't it, as solving an immediate problem in terms of finding a
yes.
tune.
As we would say, killing two birds with one stone.
Indeed. Let's talk then a little more about some of Woody Guthrie's best-known songs. I mean, you mentioned Tom Joad. Vigilante Man also is a song which has a direct connection to the Grapes of Wrath makes reference to a character in the novel and the film. But there are also songs which are inspired, as you say, by events in the newspaper and things that he's read and things that he's heard. And maybe this is the moment to talk about This Land Is Your Land.
Yes, well, This Land Is Your Land, of course, is not only Woody Guthrie's greatest and most popular song. In my view, it ranks as the greatest of all American folk songs, has the most interesting history, for sure, and is still very, very relevant today. And so when we think about Woody Guthrie, for many people, the first thing that pops up into their mind, or the first thing that they hum, is This Land Is Your Land. Many people in America might not be able to tell you anything about Woody Guthrie's life, but they do know the song This Land Is Your Land. And that in part is because in the 1950s, Woody Guthrie by this time was incapacitated, and he really could write no more and certainly couldn't sing or play or perform. But the great Pete Seeger, is one of his best music friends, decided to carry on Guthrie's tradition and keep Guthrie's music alive. And Pete Seeger would play progressive summer camps where a lot of left and of center and liberal intellectuals, particularly from New York City, would send their children to the rural areas of New York State. And there Pete Seeger would play and teach kids the songs of Woody Guthrie. And sooner or later, that particular song gets in textbooks across America, and people like myself, baby boomers, we learned Woody Guthrie's This Land Is Your Land in music class. And the reason why we did, by and large, was because our teachers told us it was a great sing-along song and it was a patriotic song. And back during the height of the Cold War, that meant a whole lot. So many of us learned how to sing by singing This Land Is Your Land as 10 or 11-year-olds.
Let's go right back to the origins of the song. In the foreword to your book, Bob, by Nora Guthrie, Woody's daughter, she talks about how the lyric is found along with other lyrics, all apparently written on the same day. There's nothing to draw attention to this song. There's nothing to suggest that Woody, at the time at least, thought that it was a particularly special song. It was just part of his day's work. But let's talk about what it was that inspired the song in the first place and indeed gave it its original title.
The original title to This Land Is Your Land was God Blessed America, and it was a direct reaction or response to the great Irving Berlin song, God Bless America. Irving Berlin had written that song in the late 19-teens, just as World War I was ending, and did not use it for a particular reason. Put it away for 20 years or so, and the great Kate Smith, who was one of America's most popular radio stars in the 1930s, a big buxom woman who had a great big voice, and just women and men loved to hear her sing, loved to have her talk on her radio shows. She had two a day. And she comes across Irving Berlin's song. She's looking for a patriotic song on the eve of World War II. Irving Berlin goes back in his catalog and finds God Bless America. He gives it to her, and almost overnight, the song becomes an incredible sensation around America in 1938-39. It's hard to turn on the radio and not hear Kate Smith's God Bless America.
Well, maybe we should pause and listen to God Bless America by Irving Berlin, sung by Kate Smith, since it was to be the inspiration, if that's the word, for This Land Is Your Land.
From the mountains
Kate Smith singing God Bless America by Irving Berlin, and you're listening to The Music Show on RN, and I'm talking to Robert Santelli, who's the author of This Land Is Your Land, Woody Guthrie and the Journey of an American Folk Song. And the journey of the song This Land Is Your Land begins with Irving Berlin's God Bless America. Bob, could you take up the story?
Sure. Well, what happens then is that Guthrie, like so many other Americans, hear it. They hear it on the radio. They hear it in jukeboxes. They hear other people singing it. There's a movement here in America to make it our new national anthem, to replace the Star Spangled Banner. There was a lot of excitement about this song. Guthrie, there's no absolute evidence of this, but many people believe Guthrie hated the song, that he just thought, oh my goodness, I can't stand it anymore. I don't even like the song. I don't think that's true. Research in Woody Guthrie archives, talking to people like Pete Seeger and Arlo Guthrie, there's no indication that Woody Guthrie detested the song or Irving Berlin. On the contrary, what probably happened was that Guthrie heard the song, admired it, but felt, very importantly, that Irving Berlin did not tell the whole story. Guthrie often thought about that with songs, and he decided to write a better song. And so he writes not God Bless America, but God Blessed America. I say this because when you listen to the lyrics, the quote patriotic lyrics of This Land Is Your Land, you can easily compare them to the lyrics of God Bless America. Both songwriters celebrate the beauty, the natural beauty of America, and both songwriters celebrate their sense of love and their patriotism for the country. Where things go different is in the last verses of This Land Is Your Land, where Woody Guthrie continues and now starts to describe an America that Irving Berlin did not describe. And these were the people on relief. These were the people who had lost their homes. These are the people who have to face no trespassing signs as the banks gobbled up lands and big wealthy oil companies and landowners took advantage of people who had lost their farms. Guthrie writes about those two, those people, and in the last two verses. Interestingly enough, those verses get lost. And when we first hear the song in the 1950s, many times, particularly in schools across America, we're only hearing the patriotic voices. There's a couple of reasons for that, potentially. One is because after the Great Depression, things get better in this country. And Guthrie might have thought that no need to sing these songs anymore because they weren't as relevant in the 1940s with the war on, everybody at work. And of course, at the end of the war, pretty much the same thing. So they get dropped. But Pete Seeger and Arlo Guthrie find them. Arlo Guthrie tells me a great story. When he was a young kid, his mom transferred him from one school to the next in Brooklyn, New York. The school that he entered, brand new, he gets there the first day and he goes to the school auditorium. And in the auditorium, everyone is singing. It's a music session, a music class. And they happen to be singing This Land Is Your Land. Everyone knew that Arlo Guthrie was Woody Guthrie's son, so they tell him, of course, to join in. Arlo is embarrassed because Arlo does not know the words and tells his dad, "Dad, we sang your song today, but I didn't know the words." So Woody got him a guitar and sang him the song, but he sang him all six verses and basically said, "That's the song they're singing. This is the song. This is the version I want you to sing and remember." So through that, Arlo Guthrie, along with Pete Seeger, who also knew those verses, become the keeper of the original intention and original title of that song. And in the 1960s and 70s, it comes back again and again. But in schools, we continue to sing the patriotic version, if you will.
Did Woody Guthrie ever record the original version?
Yes, he did. He recorded the original version. He recorded two or three versions, actually. And, you know, the one thing about the song is it's one of the most flexible songs in American music history. Guthrie and then later Pete Seeger inspired people to make up their own lyrics, use the song as a tool for protest, as a tool to rally people, as a tool to demonstrate your love of America, but also to put demands on America that it treat everybody fairly. So you could have a song this school is my school, this school is your school, you know, and take it from there. Or this car is my car, this car is your car. Do whatever you want with it. And that happened many, many times in the 1960s as many political and social causes surfaced during that decade. A lot of times the song surfaced with it.
This land is your land, and this land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway, and I saw above me that endless skyway, I saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me. I roamed and rambled, and I followed my footsteps to the sparkling sands of her diamond deserts. All around me, a voice was a-sounding, this land was made for you and me. There was a big high wall there that tried to stop me. A sign was painted, said private property. But on the backside, it didn't say nothing. This land was made for you and me. When the sun comes shining, then I was strolling, and the wheat fields waving, and the dust clouds rolling. A voice was chanting as the fog was lifting. This land was made for you and me. This land is your land, and this land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
That's Woody Guthrie singing his song, This Land Is Your Land. And it's the subject of a book called This Land Is Your Land, Woody Guthrie and the Journey of an American Folk Song by Robert Santelli, who is my guest on today's music show here on RN. The fact that the song has gone on and turns up at the inauguration of Barack Obama, sung by Bruce Springsteen and Pete Seeger and Pete's grandson, Tao Rodriguez, shows, I suppose, not just how durable it is, but also how the song continues to be relevant or comes back into relevance over the years. And those verses, the ones that got lost, seem more relevant than ever.
Yeah, you know, I think that's the sad part of it. Not only This Land Is Your Land, but also many of the songs that he wrote. You know, Woody Guthrie wrote songs about immigration, illegal immigration, and the way in which some parts of America treated these illegal aliens and then people who then kind of integrated into society and became contributors to society. He wrote about bank foreclosures. He wrote about economic disaster. He wrote about the difference between the haves and have-nots. He wrote about union problems. He wrote about so many things that sadly today, they're still relevant. So Woody Guthrie is as relevant today as he's ever been. And that's the sad part in one way, because it doesn't seem that America and the rest of the world have learned a whole lot about what he was preaching in terms of fairness and equality and making sure that everyone gets a fair chance to earn a decent living and have a good life. And Guthrie dedicated his life to that. And now people like Bruce Springsteen and others, not saying they dedicate their lives to it, but they certainly carry the torch to a certain degree and allow other young Americans to hear Woody Guthrie for the first time. Very powerful experience to hear Bruce Springsteen in concert sing This Land Is Your Land. He sings with all the heart and emotion that Woody Guthrie could muster.
Yeah, I heard him do it for the first time in 1981 in London. and he introduced it by saying, this song is for Bob Marley and the people of Brixton, the year of the Brixton riots. I'm not quite sure what Bob Marley had to do with it, but except that, of course, he was a hero in Brixton. But it and then out came This Land Is Your Land. And it's been turning up in his concerts pretty much ever since, hasn't it?
That's true. But to answer why Bob Marley, Bob Marley is the other great 20th century musical revolutionary. And Marley's material, one of the great songs, I'm sure if Guthrie heard it, he would have wished he wrote it. Get Up, Stand Up, Stand Up for Your Rights. You know? And so Springsteen correctly made that connection to Woody Guthrie, to people who are oppressed or are regressing in society instead of progressing in society, or the subject of brutality of one way or another, one sort of another, and made that connection. Springsteen still sings the song. He's a few months ago back in Austin, Texas. We have a great music conference and festival down there called South by Southwest. I know a lot of Australians go because I see the showcases and hear the Australian bands once a year when I'm down there. And Springsteen gave a keynote speech this past year and talked extensively about Guthrie and his influence on Bruce Springsteen's music.
Let's talk a little more about Woody Guthrie's life, because he's a fascinating figure, and particularly I look at those photographs of him, and you can see that in a way he's trouble. I mean, he's posing. He looks like a young Bob Dylan would, like a young Keith Richards would. He's got attitude, hasn't he?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, that's where Dylan gets his, not the other way around.
Oh, of course.
Bob Dylan in the 1960s dressed like Woody Guthrie, spoke like Woody Guthrie, sang like him, played like him, wrote like him, wanted to be Woody Guthrie. And it's the main reason why, of course, he leaves the American Midwest and heads to New York to visit Woody Guthrie before he died. But clearly, Guthrie didn't bathe much, didn't comb his hair, didn't like to change his socks or underwear, liked to be out on the road, liked to rough it. There's great stories I hear time and again of, you know, Woody Guthrie being invited to a very prominent intellectual's house in New York City, in Manhattan, and maybe had the opportunity to stay over that night and did not choose a bed, but chose the floor. And his guest would say, well, why don't you? There is a bed. There's a guest room. And Woody Guthrie says, well, I don't want to get too comfortable. I might get used to it. You know, he was that kind of guy. And he hung around with a radical crowd. You know, he'd back then, some of his most important friends, musical friends, were African Americans, people like Lead Belly and Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee. You don't hear a lot of it in his songs, but we know in his actions he was a stern advocate of equal rights for blacks and civil rights. And had he been healthy in the 1950s with the rise of Martin Luther King, you would have seen Guthrie on those lines, and you would have seen Guthrie writing the kind of songs that were necessary to fuel the American Civil Rights Movement, just like Pete Seeger was doing. But he was a guy that got in barroom brawls sometimes. He was a little guy, but a feisty fighter. He'd get locked up and arrested for vagrancy. He wasn't afraid to mingle with people that other people would feel like were not the best type to hang around with. He didn't care. He did what he wanted to do. And there's a great sense of American individuality in Woody Guthrie that you can't help but admire.
And he must have been quite a hard man to work with. I mean, you know, you read of Alan Lomax, for instance, you know, taking him under his wing, so far as anybody could take Woody under their wing. And Pete Seeger, of course, with the Almanac Singers, working with Woody Guthrie. But it must have been difficult. I mean, you must have had to cut him a lot of slack.
That's true. Very true. It's a good point, especially later on when he gets to New York City. Guthrie liked to play in saloons. He liked to play on street corners. He liked to play in boxcars on railroad tracks. When he got to the more sophisticated New York City, he found a lot of people who wanted to be an Okie, but really couldn't because they were from New York, or really were fascinated him as a kind of like a fugitive from Middle America who had been able to escape the Dust Bowl, and it was treated almost with celebrity status. kind of liked it in the beginning, but after a while, it grew less on him, and he started to have problems playing with people, performing with people. He just found them almost intolerable. He did play in the Almanac Singers, but he was not always an easy fit. He played with Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee, the great bluesman. He played with Lead Belly. He played with Lefty Lou, who was his first partner out in Los Angeles on the radio show. Did good with her, but he wasn't really somebody. He was always kind of best by himself, where he could command the stage or the microphone, tell his stories, and really do it on the fly. He was never one to play concerts per se, but when he played, you know, he kind of felt the temperature in the room or the Union Hall and was able to adapt accordingly. Bands can't do that so well, so his best stuff was always solo.
And equally, I guess he was a hard man to be married to.
Woody Guthrie was not much of a husband, nor was he much of a father. And one of his wives, his first wife actually, is still alive. And I had an opportunity to interview her for this book. And she said, you know, we were young when we got married. And I didn't realize at the time, but that Woody Guthrie could never settle down. She wanted to settle down. She had three children. She wanted a normal life. She knew she would never get that with Woody, and eventually made the smart decision to split and go back to Texas, ultimately, where she could raise her kids and let Woody go. And it wasn't something that that was a bad thing necessarily. She realized and recognized and was resigned to the fact that Guthrie was not the marrying kind. He loved his kids. I'm sure he loved his wife, but there were more important things for him other than family. And even Nora and Arlo Guthrie, even though they were young, Woody Guthrie had already become ill, so he was not able to roam and ramble like he did in the early days. But it was just not cut out to be the kind of typical American father that a lot of others, myself included, had a great opportunity to have a father who was at home and did the things that you would expect of a dad. But the Guthrie children didn't get that.
No. You're listening to The Music Show on RN. I'm talking to Robert Santelli about Woody Guthrie. The Huntington's career, which eventually killed Woody Guthrie, there's something awfully ironic about this dreadful illness, which in a sense exaggerated many of his personality traits. It sort of made him, in a way, more difficult, more distant, retreating more into himself, and ultimately, of course, completely unable to communicate properly. But it in a way, you can see why it took so long for them to diagnose it.
Yes, I mean, you know, there isn't any question in my mind that even during the last year of World War II, Woody Guthrie actually gets drafted. He had served in the Merchant Marine and did a few tours there and then came out and immediately got drafted. And he didn't see action because the war eventually would be over, but he spent some time, almost a year, in the armed forces, in the Army, actually. And it's there, we can see through the letters, that he writes back to his wife Marjorie in back in Brooklyn. He says, you know, my thoughts aren't right. They're not clear anymore. I get confused. I can't really see the way I would see normally. The thoughts don't come the way they used to. I think he must have known that not only was something wrong, but it was something that was the same thing that ultimately would kill his mother. And of course, 6-7 years later, he is in a situation where many of his friends, who had no clue that his mother had died of Huntington's disease and that he had it, they often thought he was drunk because he began to lose his balance. He began to slur his words. He began to look distant and not in the room, so to speak. And so he got this reputation, don't invite Woody Guthrie, you know, he's always drunk. And of course, that wasn't the case at all, although I must confess that Woody Guthrie was a very healthy drinker, but that certainly wasn't the situation in the early 1950s when that that disease begins to take hold of his body, and not only his body, but also his mind and his soul. And it's one of the great sad stories of American folk music, that at the height of this man, I mean, he still had a lot of music left in him, but at that height, we lose him. And even though he's still alive, it's a very slow death from the early 1950s to October 1967. But for all intents and purposes, Woody Guthrie is out of the folk music picture.
Let's talk finally about his art, Woody Guthrie, as a songwriter and as a singer as well. There's a letter which Joe Klein mentions in his biography, Woody Guthrie: A Life. Woody Guthrie writes to the Almanac Singers, and he's telling them to put more details in their songs if they really want to reach the workers. That the songs will be more authentic if they mention more places. If it's a song about a factory, if it mentions more detail about the processes in that factory and names the machines. And you hear this very much in Woody Guthrie's own songs, don't you? This fascination with detail, almost.
Not only a fascination with detail, but Woody Guthrie's best songs, and there are many of them, are really short stories put to music. When you examine them, they have settings, they have plots, they have themes, they have conflicts, they have characters. John Steinbeck was not off the mark at all when he said, basically, you had captured the whole story that I took 400 or 500 pages to write. He had this incredible ability to capture in just a few verses, some very powerful imagery, some very powerful characters that carry powerful themes. That's the beauty. That's the true brilliance of Woody Guthrie. And sometimes the politics are so strong that they overwhelm the art of this guy as a great songwriter. And all you have to do is go back to This Land Is Your Land and just hear that song. And there's a reason why that song is considered to be the greatest of all American folk songs. It's poetic. It's filled with just the right amount of detail. It's a brilliant scene and a look at an America that is becoming great, and Guthrie nails it, as he did with so many other songs. Whether you're talking about Pastures of Plenty, which is, for those listeners who don't know that song by Woody Guthrie, I would suggest that you hunt that song. It's a great song, Pastures of Plenty. One of my favorite, and certainly one of Woody's favorite. I thought it was a great song that he wrote. Another song that I would recommend, great song story, is Pretty Boy Floyd, about the true outlaw in Oklahoma during the Great Depression, that in essence became, at least legendarily or in terms of story, a modern-day Robin Hood, where he would rob banks but yet make sure that the poor people had Christmas dinners, and that kind of thing. Guthrie just was able to nail it, and it's not just his music. There is a great book that he did, and one of just a fantastic story. It's not necessarily all true. I'm talking about Bound for Glory. It's almost like an autobiographical novel, if there is such a thing. But it's based on true experiences. But Guthrie, in his way, had to create the dialogue, and if he had to manipulate a scene, he certainly had no problems doing it. But in the end, you get a detailed, wonderful glimpse, not just at Woody Guthrie, but at America in distress. It's a great book that comes out during World War II, but it's really about his time during the Great Depression, and still considered to be an American literary classic.
Robert Santelli, it's been very good to talk to you via Skype from Kansas City, Missouri. And by the way, I think you've got mail. Thanks very much for chatting to me. The book is called This Land Is Your Land, Woody Guthrie and the Journey of an American Folk Song. It's published by Running Press, and the author is my guest, Robert Santelli.
If you gather around me, people, a story I will tell about Pretty Boy Floyd, an outlaw. Oklahoma knew him well. It was in the town of Shawnee on a Saturday afternoon. His wife beside him in a wagon. And into town they rode. There a deputy sheriff approached him in a manner rather rude, using vulgar words of language, and his wife she overheard. Pretty boy grabbed the log chain and the deputy grabbed his gun, and in the fight that followed laid that deputy down. Now he took to the hills and timber to live the life of shame. Every crime in Oklahoma was added to his name. He took to the trees and the timber on the Canadian River shore, and Pretty Boy found a welcome at every farmer's door. Others tell you of a stranger that come to beg a meal, and underneath the napkin left $1,000 bill. 'Twas in Oklahoma City, it was on a Christmas day. There come a whole carload of groceries and a letter that did say, "You say that I'm a thief. Well, here's a Christmas dinner for the family's on relief. Well, it's through this world of ramble I've seen lots of funny men. Some will rob you with a six gun, and some with a fountain pen. But it's through this world you ramble, it's through this world you roam. You won't never see an outlaw drive a family from their home.
And that's the unmistakable voice of Bob Dylan, lifetime devotee of Woody Guthrie, singing Woody's song, Pretty Boy Floyd. And on the music show, you've been listening to Andrew Ford speaking with Robert Santelli, the author of This Land Is Your Land, Woody Guthrie and the Journey of an American Folk Song, which considers the life of Woody Guthrie through the prism of his most famous song. This song, including the more sensitive verses sung here in 2009 by Woody's friend and champion Pete Seeger, along with his grandson Dow, as well as Bruce Springsteen and thousands of others. Now, you can actually hear more about Woody Guthrie on RN with two programs that feature on Into the Music. The first is Today, and it's with Woody's daughter, Nora Guthrie, the guardian of his archive, an archive that's full of his drawings, illustrated diaries, and 3,000 lyrics to songs, many of them still unrecorded. The second program is next Saturday afternoon, and it's about the recording project that's bringing many of these lyrics to life, a collaborative album called Note of Hope, with performers who include Michael Franti, Arnie DeFranco, Lou Reed, Kurt Elling, Pete Seeger, Tom Morello and Madeline Peru. Note of Hope, by the way, was a phrase that Woody used to refer to the positive aspect of music in the world. That's the second Into the Music feature on Woody Guthrie, next Saturday arvo at 4 here on RN.
A great high wall
tried
to stop me.
Great big sign there.
Private property. On the other side, it didn't say nothing. That side was made for you and me.
That side was made for you and me.
Nobody living,
nobody living
can ever stop me.
I go walking,
on freedom highway.
Nobody living,
can make me turn back.
Hey, this land was made for you and me.
Everybody,
this land. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
The music show is produced by Maureen Cooney and Penny Lomax, with technical production from Richard Gervin. I'm Amanda Smith, Andrew Ford back in person with you next week.